This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. This is True Tales Told Live, where storytellers share a true tale on a particular theme, live with no notes in 7 minutes. I'm Jenny Nyman. This is an ongoing program with live events held at Odie's Deli in Soldotna. The latest was June 2nd, with a theme of nature versus not sure. KDLL recorded the event and is presenting it in two parts. Part one aired June 17th and can be heard on our website at kdll.org. Find the True Tales show in our list of programs. Today is part two with stories from Kat Sorensen, myself, and Mizi Hermanson, with Peggy Erkeneff helping out as MC. After these tales, we'll go back to a storytelling session in October with the theme of scary stories. So here we go with part two of Nature versus Not Sure. Up next, we have Kat Sorensen. Kat is a writer and journalist at the Peninsula Clarion. She is originally from New Jersey, but broke her 3-month mark on the peninsula a few days ago and loves it.
Okay, so like Jenny said, I haven't been here very long, but the story I wanted to tell tonight was about my first Alaska hike. I went with my friend Liz and Ben, that very, very, very tall man you saw walking around tonight. And as you could possibly imagine, it's hard to keep up with somebody whose legs reach your eyeballs. So we got out to Skelak Trail, and I was struggling to keep up with them the whole time. Making sure with every step I thought, okay, you can do this, okay, you can do this, okay, you can do this. It turns out I couldn't do it. It took me a very, very, very long time to finish that hike with a lot of stops that I blamed on, oh, I just have to take a picture for my mom. She's so excited I'm in Alaska. But that's not why it took me so long to do that hike. It's because I actually have been smoking for 10 years of my life, and the story I wanted to tell you tonight was how when I was on that trail, I looked around me and realized that I love hiking, I love Alaska, and I don't want to smoke because it's holding me back. So I wanted to tell you how after that hike, I went home and I broke all my cigarettes and smoked my last one in my cabin and threw them out, and that was the last cigarette that I ever had. But I can't tell you that story because I smoked a cigarette last night. So the story that I will tell you is about all the other cigarettes that I really enjoyed, but in this moment, can't deal with. We can talk about the first cigarette I ever had, which is the one where I was in my house surrounded by lighters and my dad's empty, full ashtrays, never empty, my dad's full ashtrays. And I was home alone. I was 15 years old at the time. And I was just pacing back and forth, trying to figure out something to do because I don't really, if I try to look back at it, what do 15-year-olds do with their free time? They can't leave? I don't know. That's a different story I'll think about another day. But I was just walking around, I guess, and went to go sit on the couch. And as I went to go sit on the couch, I realized that one of my dad's emergency pack of cigarettes was right there. And my dad has smoked my entire life, since the day I was born. Before I was born. And my mom smoked up until the time that her mother passed away from lung cancer. So she got the gist of it. But my dad smoked my entire life. My mom smoked. And I sit down on the couch to just watch TV, and I crush my dad's cigarettes. And I'm like, God, I'm going to get in trouble for this. So I get up and I go to put him on the table. But instead of putting on the table, I open it up. And instead of then closing it and putting on the table, I open it up and I take out a cigarette. And instead of putting the cigarette back and closing it and putting it on the table, I open it up, I take out the cigarette, and I put it in my mouth, and I smoke it, and I'm 15 years old, and I smoke my first cigarette. And I hated every second of it. Said, I'm never going to do it again. That was disgusting. That was horrible. For the next 5 years, I told myself and everyone around me, smoking's bad. It's killing my father. Just look at it. And then I smoked another cigarette, and it was delicious. I was on the canals of Venice with the man I thought I was going to marry, and he was a heavy smoker at the time. And he looks at me, and he says, you know, it would be great right now if we could just share a cigarette. And I said, oh, yes, it would. So we pass this Lucky Strike back and forth as we dangle our toes in the canals of Venice. And doesn't that just sound amazing? And then I started dabbling a little bit here and there. And then the next cigarette that I distinctly remember is the one that I smoked as I walked away from his house because he broke my heart and I never saw him again. And then from that point on, I said, hey, it's his fault I'm smoking. He gave me that pack of cigarettes. But it's not his fault that I was smoking. It's in my nature. I grew up around cigarettes. I am anxious by nature, and somehow they calm me down. And I have all of these great memories of my life and smoking a cigarette at this point in my life and things like that. But I need to change my nature because I want to be out in this world and experience everything that Alaska has to offer and not fall so very far behind my friend Liz, because she is really good at hiking and I am really bad at saying no to a cigarette. So last night, I get home and I'm very, very excited. Good day at work, gonna go out, do some stuff, I don't know, have fun. And I walk into the house and there's a pack of yellow American Spirits sitting right on the counter. I love yellow American Spirits. It's been 2 months since I smoked one, and I didn't smoke a cigarette for a very, very, very long time after that hike. But a lot of memories flooded back when I saw that there. I'm like, oh, I really, really would like that. So I go and I pick up the pack of cigarettes. And instead of putting them down, I pick up the pack of cigarettes and I open it up. And instead of closing it and putting it back down, I pick up the pack of cigarettes. I open it up. I take out a cigarette. And here's the weird part. I spend 5.5 minutes looking for a lighter. 5.5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, gosh, this is bad. But I smoke it and it's enjoyable. It's fine. I have a good time. I love cigarettes, as I've mentioned. But afterwards, I'm like, why did I do that? That was, in 5 years, the longest I had ever gone without smoking a cigarette, 2.5 months, and I just felt miserable, and I felt horrible, and it wasn't just mental, it was emotional, it was physical, my nose was running, I started coughing, and I just felt like a giant pile of poop. So I smoked it, and I guess I can't tell you the story of the last cigarette that I've ever smoked because I am not 100% confident in myself that that will be it, but I am 100% confident that it is no longer in my nature because I did not enjoy that cigarette. And you know what I did enjoy? I enjoyed going up Skyline Trail this morning and kind of being able to keep up with everybody even though I'm trying really hard at getting super fit. So thank you.
Thank you, Kat. That was awesome. And I have to say, wearing my hat where I deal with all the media on the peninsula and in Anchorage for the last 6 years through my job, she's so excited to tell good stories. And yesterday, she learned about this event a while ago, and she said she really wanted to come, and we were talking about the moth and storytelling, and I saw her yesterday where drones were flying around with a bunch of kids, and I said, I said, we could use one or two more storytellers. I'll tell one. So she just decided and said yes yesterday that she would do this. So thank you, Kat. So it's my privilege to actually get to introduce Jenny to us right now. And I love that she can take translating words and writing and thoughtful stories and funny stories and soulful stories that she did in print for so long with Readout Reporter, and now in her current incarnation, as she says, so she's the general station manager at KDLL. And it's also really fun because at a borough assembly meeting, when I looked in the back corner one night, I saw Shaylin back at KDLL. So we've got some great things happening in our community with some stories and reporting and news. And so Jenny has a story, though, to tell us now about an adventure of nature and nurture, not sure. So, Jenny.
All
I wasn't in the middle of nowhere Canada because there's an awful lot of nowhere Canada. So I was more in the middle of not much Canada. I was about 3 weeks into a 4 month road trip down the Alcan, across the country, trying to hit as many national parks as I could. So I would hike during the day and then drive to my next trail and sleep in my car at the trailhead and get up and hike again the next morning. And it was September, and I was in the Rocky Mountains, kind of north of Jasper National Park, I think the Alberta side of that. And I got to that particular trailhead pretty late at night. It was about 11:30, so I park, and I figure, okay, I need to get straight into bed. But by this point in the trip, I had a pretty good routine down for all my little systems. I had built a little bunk in the back of the car, so bedtime meant take off my coat and make sure my car keys are safe in the pocket and put that back on the bunk, take my cell phone and my headlamp and stow those by my pillow in case I needed them in the middle of the night, and then I get out the driver's side door and I open the back door and I hit lock on the driver's side door and I close that, and then I get in the back door and pull it closed behind me so I'm all nice and safe and secure for the night. Except that particular parking lot, I didn't realize it when I drove in, but was it kind of an incline? Not enough so it was really visible, but enough so that when I locked and closed the front door and went to pivot to get in the back door, I just barely managed to hip check the door. And with that and the incline was enough to swing it shut. And of course, it was already locked. So now my coat and my keys and my cell phone and my headlamp are all snuggled, all nice and secure in my nice warm sleeping bag in my now locked car. That sleeping bag was so nice and warm, in fact, that even though it was September in the Rocky Mountains, I didn't have to wear a lot of layers to bed because it was so warm in there. And since I was ready for bed, that meant that I also had no pants. So what do you do in this situation? Of course, obviously, you break the window, right? So I find myself a good two-hander rock, and I line up on that window, and I whack it with everything it's worth. And that rock comes bouncing back at my face, because safety glass is no joke. They say shatter-resistant, and they mean it. I put 34 scratches in that window without so much as a hairline crack. At which point I realize, okay, I'm going to need a plan B. So on my drive in, I had seen some houses, but they were a ways back and it is now pitch dark. So if I'm going to walk myself to try and find help, I look up the other side of the road and way off in the distance, there's a light. So, okay. Go towards the light, right? We've all heard this before. That seems like a plan. So I start walking. And eventually I see that the road now goes through a fence. And I keep walking. And I get closer and I see that this fence is topped with, yeah, that's razor wire. Keep walking. Get close enough that I can start making out the signs, the majority of which are along the lines of stop, no entry, turn around, yes, we mean you. And there's one very large sign that designates the facility as a federal correctional institute. And I figure, well, I've made it this long in my life without going to prison. I guess that's gonna change. So I keep walking my half-naked self up into this prison past all kinds of signs in French and English saying, no. And sure enough, up the road, there is a guard station, and I can see through the window that there is somebody manning the guard station. But I think the guard was probably more concerned with people breaking out of the prison than breaking into the prison, because he did not see me coming. So I get up there, and I knock on the glass to get his attention, and I scare the maple syrup out of this guy. He looks at me and goes, ah! And then he looks down at me and goes, ah! And all I could do at that point is go, hi. And you always hear that Canadians are the friendliest people on the planet, right? This gentleman was not happy that I was there. But he was friendly, I suppose, enough to let me use his phone. So I call the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as one does in that situation. And luckily, the dispatcher was one of the friendliest people on the planet. Oh, dear. Oh, I'm so sorry. Let's see what we can do for you. So she looks up the phone numbers of three tow truck companies in the vicinity. Of course, this being middle of not much Canada, in the vicinity meant 50 to 100 miles. And it is now about 1 a.m. So I dial the first number and it rings 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 and rings and rings and rings and rings. No answer. Okay, number two, fax machine. Okay, lucky number three. And it rings 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 and it rings. And at that point, I'm trying to game out in my head, like, I don't know which is worse, having to stay in here with this guy. At least it's warm, or I really don't want to stay in here with this guy. Please answer the phone. Sure enough, eventually a very sleepy man answers the phone. And he luckily was also one of the friendliest people on the planet because he says, sure, I'll come let you into your car. So we work out where exactly I am. And I go running my pasty self back down the road to meet him, expecting at any moment that these gates are going to slam shut in front of me. But no, they do let me actually leave the prison. And I get to my car just about the time he is pulling up. Now, he gets out of the car, and if he notices that I am missing a significant portion of my wardrobe, he does not let on. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't ask anything. I don't notice him so much as even glance down. But he does proceed to start lecturing me about how dangerous it is for me to be out at night all alone. And you really should be more careful about this. And he's an older gentleman, so I figure I'm getting the fatherly lecture about, you know, stranger danger, and I'm going to get myself abducted or assaulted or something. And no, turns out he wasn't worried about other humans harassing me, as he starts to tell me, you know, it's really dangerous out here. You really got to be careful on account of the cougars. The what? Oh, yeah, this area, it's lousy with cougars. Again, what? Oh, yeah, those houses up the road, yeah, they lose pets all the time. They can't let their kids play outside at night. It's just, you know, on account of the cougars, because they'll get you. And at this point, I am not the friendliest person on the planet. Sir, I am tired, and I am cold, and I just broke into a prison. And I don't know if you noticed, but I have no pants. Let me into the car. Which he does, and I am reunited with my clothes. And I learned three valuable lessons that night. One, I do not like to be in nature au natural. So I have made it a point to always have clothing within my direct control. Two, prisons should only be visited by appointment. And three, even if things don't necessarily get worse, they can always get weird. Especially on account of the cougars.
So we've had eight awesome storytellers tonight. What do you think? Are you going to come back? Woo! That was fun. And we have a special treat tonight. Meezy, would you like to come up and give us a share of whatever's speaking to you to speak to us?
So this is called The Seventh Wave. Quote, folklore says the seventh wave is bigger than the previous six. And there's some statistical evidence to back this up. Breverton's Nautical Curiosities. It's a lumpy day on the flood, and the day brought all the troubles that come with 20-foot tides in Cook Inlet. If the force of the wind increases by the square of its speed, well then by my careful calculations, we are toast. We have two choices, to go or to stay. Maritime wisdom suggests keeping a thumb's width from danger as measured on a nautical chart. If only it were that easy. With no protected port, a sou'wester is a double-edged sword. It often brings bounty. It always brings hardship. It can blow the run inshore, but in order to reap the reward, we have to launch straight into the storm. No matter whose thumb is used for the measure, today we are well within a digit of danger. This season we are short-handed, but making the best of it. Stormy days we feel it most. With our pared-down crew, we decide to launch. John drops the skiff in the surf, but before he can park Alice in the trailer, we are blown off the pull-out line. I can't recall the last time we had a failure to launch. We try again. Trailer the skiff. Drop it in the surf. This time my cousin's crew helps us hold steady, waiting for the flat spot. I don't count to see if it comes after the seventh wave. Folklore can't help us now. We hop in the skiff and pull it into the froth. Waves break over the bow, soaking us before the outboard's even running, but we manage to get clear of the beach. Sou'westers always bring hardship. It's time to see if this one brings a bounty.
This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. You just heard part two of True Tales Told Live, Nature versus Not Sure, a storytelling event held live at Odie's Deli in Soldotna on June 2nd. Part one of that evening aired on KDLL on June 17th and can be found on our website at kdll.org. Now we're going to go back to a previous storytelling event held in October at Odie's with the theme of scary stories. Caitlin Vodla was the MC. We'll hear stories from Sarah Pahala, Bunny Swan Geese, Meryl Sikorsky, and Bill Holt.
Our next storyteller is Sarah Pahala, and she is very perceptive of her surroundings, and it might be because she is descended from Irish fairy people who got in trouble for stealing other people's sheep and a line of well witchers. And so this is leading into her abilities for the first time ever telling a story that will raise the hairs on your knees and scare your children's children into the backs of their own closets. So, without further ado, this is Sarah Pahala.
It was 13 years ago this month, while I was living in a rather run-down home up in Ridgeway, when I found myself bored and binging on HGTV. After watching half a day's worth of home remodeling shows, I became thoroughly motivated to paint one of the upstairs bedrooms. So I went into the room, measured the square footage, and off to the store I went. Once there, I picked out primer, ceiling paint, wall paint, and the necessary trim. The determination I felt to start this simple project was blinding. What I had thought would be an easy task soon became extremely involved and difficult. For one, the walls were covered with a nasty panel board, which hadn't been nailed into place, but rather glued. This, of course, wasn't discovered until I tore these panels down and found that the sheetrock located behind them was unfinished. There wasn't a seam that had been taped, and the glue had torn the smooth finish from the sheetrock face. This benign painting project would now take a week instead of a day. It was during this very renovation when things started to get interesting. See, my bedroom happened to be located in the basement beneath the room being flipped. Midweek, I was abruptly startled from a sound sleep and found myself to be silently screaming because of severe pain in my left side. Something was crushing my ribs and I could do nothing to stop it. At this point, I was only able to open my eyes and was attempting without success to move my arms in order to remove whatever it was from my side and was paralyzed. After what seemed like an eternity, I was finally able to move my arms and began frantically brushing them along my left chest wall, trying to push whatever it was off of me. Nothing was there. I then started to search with my eyes around the room, only to discover that the lights from my clock and the nightlight at the foot of my bed were absent. When I looked up and over to the left, a heavy black fog, which exuded anger, hung in the air. My heart raced, and all I could think to do was begin repeating the phrase, "The Lord is my shepherd," over and over in my head. And yes, I was raised Catholic. Following about the 100th repetition, the mist disappeared, the grip released my ribs, and the lights were once again visible. It took me another hour to build up the courage to get out of bed and turn the lights on in the room. When I did, there were four finger-like bruises forming along my side. Bruises that could not have physically been caused by myself or another, especially since I was alone in the house. The very next day, I was putting the finishing touches on the drywall before starting to paint. At the time, I was facing one of the corners, sanding the dried mud, and I did have one of those snazzy vacuum systems to eliminate dust and a particulate mask in place. All of a sudden, every hair went up along my spine. In my mind's eye, I could clearly see a furious man standing, fists clenched behind me. He stood there with a thick white hair, farmer tanned arms, white t-shirt, and Carhartt khakis. Slowly, I reached down and turned off the vacuum. I then turned to face him, yet when I did, no one was there. I shook this off and went back to work. Not 1 minute later, after having just resumed my sanding job, he was back. My hair was on end, and I was whelmed by his fury. Without turning around, I reached down to shut off the vacuum, and in a firm voice, I stated, "You need to leave. You need to leave." Only then did I turn around to find that I was alone in the room. I finished sanding and put things away for the day, opting to give the room some space. Rather unnerved by this experience, I contacted the aunt of the person whose house I was living in. I recounted my tale with clarity of mind, and her response was matter of fact. "Sounds like my father was visiting you." He was always outraged whenever anything was changed in that house while he was alive. "It appears you handled him well. He should leave you alone from now on." And although this didn't sit well with me, since both experiences were surrounding with an overwhelming sense of fury, I decided to go with that mindset. By week's end, I had finished with the painting project. It actually turned out really nice. The engine gray walls, white gray ceiling, white base molding, and crown molding wrapping the room. It was actually something that any program on HGTV would have been proud to showcase, minus the strange occurrences surrounding the remodel. About a week later, a gas leak was discovered in the boiler room across from where I'd been sleeping. NSTAR quickly came out and fixed the problem. It remains a mystery whether the apparitions were real or due to gas-induced hallucinations. I'll leave that determination up to you.
Now, here is Bunny Swan Geese.
Oftentimes, fairy tales, tall tales, they have begun when we were very small children, and not necessarily always were they sweet or kind, such as "Rock-a-bye Baby in the Treetop," "When the wind blows, your cradle will rock," "When the bough breaks, your cradle will fall." Bummer. "Down goes baby." Yeah, not too sweet. My mom used to say her parents, my grandparents, would tell them, "Here is a candle to light you to bed. Here is an axe to chop off your head." So, and I think the axe part is about so you won't get out of the bed. I think that's the part that, you know. So that's all I could think of. So in our culture, the story I'm going to share with you, actually I'm going to share with you three very short stories. And these stories are ancient Dena'ina Athabaskan stories, and they are for teaching and learning and tough love. And oftentimes it was not unusual in this climate, if you had seven children and an aunt or uncle had three, they may send one or two over to the aunt and uncle's house to stay with them for the winter because it was there was more food and available supplies. However, stories for children who were not to learn things and were not doing so well, they would also send those children off. Now, the first story I'm going to share with you is called The Stupid Boy. So, young lad, young boy, he's really quite intelligent. He's bright, he's funny, he's mostly good, but sort of not. So the parents say, look, we're going to send you off to your Uncle Sam's house because he's going to teach you a few lessons. And if you don't learn anything, don't bother coming home. Whoa, tough love. So sure enough, he goes to Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam takes, I don't like the Uncle Sam part, let's use Uncle Joe. Uncle Sam is a little too familiar with the climate. So Uncle Joe takes him to an edge, a cliff's edge, canyon down below, far, distant, deep. On the edge of this canyon stood a very medium tall spruce tree. He asked the young boy to climb up the spruce tree. Young boy looks down. Big canyon. Uncle says, well, what you gonna do? Okay. So young boy begins to climb up the spruce tree. Well, can you get any further? Young boy says, sure, I can. He says, all right, go ahead. So young boy climbs up the spruce tree. He keeps looking down at the canyon. Uncle gets out his axe. Starts whacking away at the spruce tree. The young boy, Unc, what you doing, Unc? He says, well, I don't know. What are you going to do about it? Boy says, I don't know. I'm hanging on. That's it, Uncle says. So he starts chopping away. Young boy says, Unc, what are you doing to me? He says, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, just then, as the young boy clung to the tree, a big swift wind comes along. He tried to explain. He tried again to think a little better than that. So, well, you know, life happens. If you don't learn quick, sometimes you could lose it. Hence the stupid boy. Next story, another stupid boy. So this guy, he's intelligent, he's kind, he's funny. Dang, he's lazy. Don't do nothing. Says, yeah, I'm gonna take care of that right away. And he's like, I'm tired. So next thing you know, mom and dad say, look, Timmy, you're going over to your aunt and uncle's place north of here for some time. And you know, you really got to get better at chores. You got to learn more. If you don't, good knowing you. So he's, 12 by now, pretty big. Heads over to his uncle's and aunt's house. They say, hey, guess what, Timmy? We're going out. We're going to go hunting, and we're going to show you how to make a deadfall trap. Timmy says, yoo-hoo, all right. Gonna learn how to hunt and get me a bear. Sure enough, they set up camp. Everybody's happy. They go out into the forest, and they build a deadfall trap. This is real cool. Big log, bait, like this. Yeah, that's it. Okay, so they get it all set up. Sure enough, that big bear comes along. Whacko. Good one. So they go back to camp. Well, Timmy is a little impatient, and he keeps bothering his uncle and aunt, inquiring about checking the trap. They said, no, Tim, no, you can't go right now. We'll all go together. He said, please, you gotta let me go. Fine. Well, aren't you coming? No. So Tim runs out to the deadfall trap. Quite a bit of time passes. He does not return. So sure enough, they get out there, and what did they discover? Timmy's little legs poking out from under the big old log. Hey, that's not funny. Accidents do happen. And if you don't learn, again, tough love. So they just took his little body and took it over to that cliff, you know, that big canyon was, and he just rolled the little body over the edge. And his cousin was over there. So. The end. Okay, so. I know. Now, these are bedtime stories, okay? Okay, third story. Stupid boy who succeeds. So, same problem. Nice kid, bright kid. Kind of lazy, smarty pants. He's a little brighter than usual, but he's still a smarty pants. So sure enough, they take him out to the edge of the canyon. They send him over to his aunt and uncle's house. And it's the canyon lesson. Take him to the edge of the canyon. They got to find a new tree. Look out the canyon. Look down there, kid. Yeah. All right, hey, climb up that tree over there. You want me to climb up that tree? Yeah, I want you to do that. Okay, so the young guy, you know, wants to be sure and be brave. So sure enough, Uncle takes out his big old axe and he starts chopping away at the tree. And the kid says, Uncle, what are you doing? He says, what are you going to do about it? And sure enough, kid jumps right out of that tree. Uncle goes over to him and he says, you're pretty smart. Take my spear. Gotta look after yourself and let's go home. The end. So, tough love. And you know, I had done these in some school with children, and I got a mother who was quite enraged at me. She said, my son is not gonna be the stupid boy. She learns. He is good. Thank you so much.
The next storyteller is Meryl Sikorsky. Meryl, you tell lots of stories about our community, and now we'd like to hear one of your stories.
My parents had sex 3 times. I have proof. I have a brother and a sister. My father was a command pilot in World War II. My mother was sort of a high society girl in Detroit, Michigan. She stood 4'11". And my dad was a farmer after the war. There never was any candy, flowers. There was never any romantic dinners out. Okay, there was work. There was mucking out the stalls, of which Mom partook. But romance, no. My brother, when we were playing one hot summer day, threw a hose, or plastered a hose in my ear, and I'm deaf in my left ear to this day, went through some excruciating pain. But when I was about 4 years old, he looked at me, and, you know, it was getting close to Christmas time, okay? And he says, only stupid little kids believe in Santa Claus. And I started bawling, and I ran to my dad, the colonel, right, who was sitting in his chair. And I said, Dad, John says there's no Santa Claus and only stupid little kids believe in Santa Claus. My dad patted his knee. And I climbed up in the chair on my dad's knee. And he said, about a year before you were born, I was shot down behind enemy lines in France. It was a stormy night. And parachute hit the power lines, and I free fell about 20, 30 feet to the ground, and I don't remember anything after that. I lost consciousness. When I woke up, my parachute had been packed, was under my head, and there was a bicycle next to me in the ditch. And he said, "Don't let anybody tell you there's no Santa Claus." I believe in Santa Claus to this day. I got a birthday coming up. I was born Election Day, November 4th. I won't tell you what year, but you can Google it, okay? Because my mother always, you know, told the story that when she went under the ether to give birth, which they, you know, they did in that generation, that she was sure that Dewey was going to be the next president of the United States, and that she was going to have a baby girl, because my big sister wanted a baby girl. And when she came out, she had a brown-eyed baby boy, and Truman was president, okay? So it's a big birthday that's coming up November 4th for me. I'm glad that's not an election day. But birthdays started bothering me. When I was about 12 or 14, I really started realizing, why? I didn't have anything to do with it, you know? I wasn't doing the backstroke, hit the egg, you know? I have no consciousness of being born. Why all the presents? So I started a little tradition of my own, which kind of made me appreciate my mom, because, I mean, it was all about her. I like Phyllis Diller's line, "Guys, if you want to know what childbirth is like, grab your upper lip and pull it over your forehead." Then maybe you'll appreciate, you know, what it was like. So I started a tradition. I would call my mom and I'd say, "Okay, Mom, 25 years ago today, where were you?" And she would tell me the story. And the story went, you know, something like this. "Well, just before I went under the ether, I had a panic attack because your sister wanted a baby sister. And we had picked a name of your father's girlfriend in Sweden named Wanda. And we didn't have a name for a boy. So I looked up at my dad." My grandfather was a physician, and he was in attendance. And I said, "Big Duppy." That's what he was called, Big Duppy. "What if it's a boy?" And so he said, "Well, if it's a boy, you can name it after his grandfather's. We'll call him Merrill Stephen." And when she woke up, she had a brown-eyed baby boy, Merrill Stephen, and a Democrat for president. And I would, as the years went by, would always call her, and she'd always tell me the same story. Okay, well, Mom passed away. And so I called Dad on my birthday. And I said, "Okay, Dad, it's your turn. You're up. Tell me their story." "Well, I couldn't be there." "Why couldn't you be there?" "I was at Walter Reed Hospital recuperating from a broken back." So my dad raised racehorses, and in the trophy room, I found a plaque. It was a Caterpillar Club, and during World War II, if you were a command pilot or if you bailed out behind enemy lines and if you brought your parachute out, they framed the ripcord. And the date on his Caterpillar Club trophy said October 5th, 1945. So I did a little sixth grade math. I was born November 4th, 1946. Okay. So you do the math, and I said, "Okay, Dad, if you weren't there when I was born, and you were shot down behind enemy lines, and you rode the bicycle out, you know, and then were returned to the country, where were you when I was conceived?" Command pilot, okay? We were only given orders growing up. That's all. And my dad blushed, and he looked down, and he said, "Just wanted to be sure all the equipment worked." So, my mother, 4'11", okay, Victorian, they only had sex 3 times. Walter Reed Hospital, no private rooms, okay. 9 months before, 3 months after my dad, with a broken back, pulled the drapes, okay? And so I'm imagining this now, because Dad's not going to give me the details. But there's only one way it could have happened. She had to climb up on top of my dad's bones to make sure the equipment worked, and bang, baby, brown-eyed boy, Meryl Sikorsky.
Thank you, Meryl. You're a great storyteller. We've got lots of great storytellers here tonight. Thanks for being brave. Telling a story is tough. We're going to have Bill Holt come up next. Some of you may know him because he just ran for a borough assembly against a candidate whose main platform was that political correctness has gone too far. The implication being that Bill himself is too politically correct. Bill is here to dispel that perception.
Thank you, Caitlin. The name of my story, I have a title for my story. It's Call Me Ishmael. I first came to Alaska in the early 1970s. I'd been living in California and going to school in Colorado. And I sort of had a romantic interest in Alaska. I thought this is going to be something that I had an intrinsic feeling this is going to be a great place to live. And so I was also full of literature. I was really fond of Moby Dick. I was really fond of Walt Whitman and the Song of the Open Road. And so I wanted to go off to Alaska to find myself and experience nature to the fullest. So like the old man in the sea, I sort of started hitchhiking up to Alaska to seek my fortune and find myself. So in the early 1970s, I got a friend that had been fishing up here as a set net fisherman for a couple of years, and he lined me up with the McElroy family in Kusilov to come up and set net fish with them. So I hitchhiked up to Alaska. I arrived at the McElroy's homestead, and great folks, and Pat and Mary Jo said, well, you can head on down to the beach cabin. And at the beach cabin, you know, that's where Larry is, and you and Larry can straighten you out on what you need to know for set net fishing. So it was great. I went down to the beach cabin, and there was my friend Larry, who I'd gone to college with, and he was kind of a romantic kind of character too, loved fishing and loved the outdoors. So Larry and I, you know, I got there the first night, and the next morning we woke up and beautiful view of Cook Inlet. It was just a wonderful spot right on the beach. And so we're looking out the windows of the beach cabin at Cook Inlet, and I thought I was seeing icebergs rolling around in the water out there. And I thought, well, it's kind of late in the year for icebergs. What's the deal? And Larry said, oh, those are belugas. Those are whales. And so I thought, well, that's really pretty cool that, you know, there's a whole bunch of whales. And I'd just been reading Moby Dick, so I knew all about whales. So, these whales are out there, and that's a pretty cool thing. And then Larry said, you know, every year here, they have a 4th of July parade, and they sell beluga burgers. You can get beluga burgers at the 4th of July parade. I think Bunny remembers this. And so we thought, Larry said, you know, I really think we should try and harpoon a whale, and so we could market these whales as beluga burgers, and you know, and for the 4th of July thing. And I thought, you're crazy, I've read Moby Dick, and I know all about how malevolent these damn whales are. And so anyway, he said, yeah, we could probably do it, and it's legal, everything's fine, and it'll probably be our last chance, because this is going to go the way of all things, and you're not going to be able to harpoon whales much longer. So I thought, well, he's nuts, but he's just talking. And then, he had a forge. Larry had this little forge set up, so he decided he was going to go make a harpoon. So Larry started forging up this harpoon, and this one on for a couple days, and he had forged up this harpoon. It was an ugly, gaudy thing. It had a great big tip and some kind of a thing on it for sticking. And so anyway, he made this harpoon, and I just still at this point thought this was just a joke. You know, he's just having fun with this harpoon. But Larry had also made this small, about 10-12 foot boat. And it was made out of like 3/8 plywood. It just looked kind of like a coffin, really. And it kind of came around to the bow. It had this big bowsprit. And Larry's idea was, then we could go out, if we see these whales again, we'll go out and harpoon one of these suckers, and we'll go for a Nantucket sleigh ride with this little boat that he has. So I thought, well, yeah, sure, Larry. And so a few days later, he had his harpoon all made up. And he had some halibut ground line tied to the harpoon to use for this thing. And he's kind of out there with his binoculars looking at, you know, looking at the mouth of the river. And all of a sudden, oh, shit, there's a bunch of whales in the mouth of the river again. So I thought, oh, great, you know. And so I started getting kind of excited about it, too, because I was full of all the romance of whaling and all that. And, you know, and so it's kind of this thar she blows kind of a mood in the room. So anyway, we decide Larry's really serious. He's going to go down, and he wants me to come with him, and we're going to go harpoon a whale. And at this point, I'm sort of thinking, well, this still seems kind of exciting, and, you know, we haven't done it, and it sounds kind of cool, so, yeah, maybe we should take the next step and go down and get the boat, put it in the water, and go out and at least look at, you know, the whales up close. So we go down to the beach. And the whales are right in the mouth of the Kasilof River, and there's a really big pod of belugas. And belugas are not like Moby Dick. They're not coming out of the water and jumping. They're just sort of rolling out there. So we decide to actually go out and do this. So Larry's got his harpoon, and we coil the line up in the bottom of the boat, and then we tie the end of this ground line onto this bow stem of the boat. Now, I want to be kind of clear. If we ever actually did harpoon a whale and a line pulled tight, it would just pull the boat in half. So in a sense, the boat really was kind of like Queequeg's coffin. Yeah, so anyway, we get down there, and so we're getting ready to launch the boat. And we could see the whales. And then the neighbors had this beautiful black Labrador that came running down the beach. He always wanted to play with us. And he jumps in the boat with us. And we thought, well, this is really no place for a dog. So we get the Labrador back out of the boat. We go to launch the boat again. And the Labrador jumps in the boat with us again. So we thought, well, what the heck? You know, we'll just take the dog with us, too. We're kind of a motley crew. And we'll just go out. Everybody go out, and we'll just go harpoon a whale with a dog. So anyway, we go. Larry had this kind of this little one-cylinder British Seagull motor. It just was like pop, 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 pop. It made the boat go about 3 miles an hour. So we start kind of motoring out towards these whales that are still rolling around. And the whole time I'm starting to think, well, this seemed like a good idea earlier, but I'm not really sure about this. I was starting to have some doubts. But remember, I was kind of in my early 20s. I want to read something I just got from Wikipedia here. Not WikiLeaks. This is the function. This is has to do with the human mind. The function of the frontal lobe involves the ability to project future consequences from current actions. So I was kind of in a situation there where my frontal lobe really wasn't quite developed. And I know that Larry's wasn't very developed either, but it was starting to be an emerging presence in my life that there might be some consequences on things. And so we're motoring out towards these whales. And so I look back in the back, and there's kind of Larry like Captain Ahab, you know, with this determined look on his face. And we're trying to sneak up on these whales. And I am Queequeg. I'm in the front, and Larry has me grab the harpoon. So I've got this harpoon, and the boat was really too small to stand up in. All I could do was just kind of get up on my knees, and we're getting closer to the whales. And I'm kind of starting to raise the harpoon up, and I'm thinking, this might actually happen. So as we're getting closer and closer to these whales, I've got the harpoon up, and I'm nervously looking back at Larry, and he's just steely-eyed, aiming for one of these malevolent devils. And I'm thinking, boy, this is not like Moby Dick. These things seem kind of like teddy bears out there, kind of floating around. They're real beautiful. But as we got closer, even though they're small, they started seeming pretty damn big. And I'm thinking all along, my frontal lobe is having a real real maturing moment at this point, because it's really kind of coming forward and thinking, whoa, so this could be bad. And so I'm kind of there queequeging in the front of the boat with this harpoon, and Larry's getting, we're getting closer and closer to these whales, and now we're actually within distance where I probably, if I was a harpooner, I could have harpooned one of these whales. And so we're sneaking around, and Larry's looking for the big one. He wants to make sure we get a big one. And so he's kind of motoring around, and they don't come up. A lot of these kind of roll up, and we're getting ready there, and I realize, this is a do or die moment. I can actually throw this harpoon, and this might actually happen, and we might go on this Nantucket sleigh ride. And the reality then sort of struck me that I probably won't live through this either. So we're getting really close to the whales, and we're just about ready to harpoon a whale, and the Labrador retriever in the boat kind of sticks his head up, and he sees the whales too. And so the Labrador retriever sees these whales, and he jumps out of the boat, tries to get to the whales. So all of a sudden, I was saved, because now the Labrador Retriever's out there paddling around in Cook Inlet trying to catch a whale, and we had to get the Labrador Retriever back in the boat. So in the process of getting the retriever, retrieving the retriever out of the water, we got the retriever back in the boat, and thank God those whales were gone.
That will do it for this edition of True Tales Told Live on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. To hear more stories from your community, the next True Tales event will be held at 7 p.m. October 13th at Odie's Deli in Soldotna with the theme of Family Recipes for Disaster. If you would like to tell a story, you can message the organizers at the True Tales Told Live page on Facebook, and you can listen to audio of these programs at kdll.org. I'm Jenny Nyman. Thanks for listening.